The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Get the power to do more with Sky's best ever Wi-Fi.
Welcome back. It's Oliver Callan here in for Ryan for today and some other days as well. The text is 51551. And the email is ryan@rte.ie. Nearly getting it right. Anyway, I'm joined in studio this morning by another human. It's been a while since I've seen humans this close, even though we're far away. And sorry, I'm joined by journalist and the anchor of 6-1 News, Mr. David McCullough, who's also a historian of some renown, with a particular interest in the history of Irish politics. And we're here to discuss the weird and wonderful people, Irish people particularly, featured in the Dictionary of Irish Biography. Which has just gone online.
It's just gone online. Free access, open to everybody, anybody in Ireland, anybody around the world. Yeah. And it is just such an incredible resource. It's really fantastic. There are about 11,000 lives outlined in this. And anybody can log on www.dib.ie.
I'm looking at it here. It looks great.
And look up anybody they like. And it's fantastic. It has been, it was first published in 2009 as sort of a hard copy. And I have one of the volumes there, yeah. Which if you hit somebody over the head with would do a fair bit of damage. That's one of 11 volumes.
Okay.
Right? So if you had enough money and you had enough shelf space, they'd be a very handsome addition to your bookshelves.
I actually looked it up. You know, all the volumes were about 1,000 sterling. Yeah. Apparently, on some
of
those sites.
And they would take up quite a lot of space in your house as well. But they look good. But anyway, it is now, thanks to the Royal Irish Academy, thanks to Dr. Kate O'Malley, who drove the project, thanks to money, most importantly from the Higher Education Authority, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Dublin City Libraries, is now online, free to everybody anywhere in the world to look up some of these just fantastic stories.
And what is the Dictionary of Irish Biography? I mean, who's written it?
Well, it's written by, there's a team of historians. It's run by the Royal Irish Academy with funding from the HEA, and there's a team of historians who laboured away for years and years and years to get the initial volumes out, and then it's updated because obviously more people sadly become eligible for the thing, because you have to be dead before you get into it.
You've been dead 5 years.
So more people become eligible. And they're also going back and digging out, you know, interesting, unusual lives that might have been missed the last time. Because when the first volumes came out, you know, you had your politicians, you had your civil servants, you had your well-known artists and actors and all the rest of it. But there's lots of other lives out there. And one of the things I know that that struck them at the time was only about 10% initially of the lives in it were women. So they have tried to, and that's a reflection of the lack of opportunities, you know, women had in Irish society.
Yes.
But in times past.
They weren't in power, so therefore
they didn't tend to. But there's lots of fascinating stories here they've been able to add to over the years. So in order to get into the Dictionary of Irish Biography, as I said, you had to be dead for about 5 years, because they feel that gives a sort of a length of time to give somebody a fair appraisal. You have to be born in Ireland or have a significant connection with Ireland. Like, for instance, I was just noticing in this volume, Merlin Rees is in it, the former Northern Ireland Secretary, British politician, okay, who of course wasn't born in Ireland but did have an impact on developments here. And you have to have, you know, had an unusual or a significant or a notable life.
And what would people be using this for, generally?
Well, the Taoiseach, when he was launching it yesterday, said there's something in it for everyone, from junior cert students to college professors. So if you are a junior cert student researching your history or whatever it might be, you can have a look at people you might be interested in. In my own research, when I was writing books on Eamon de Valera, there's just a huge range of people, because he lived for 93 years, whatever it was.
Yeah.
He interacted with a lot of people. So I was absolutely amazed by the number of actual links I was able to find, the number of biographies I was able to find. I'll give you two examples. One from the start of his career. He was a teacher in Rockwell. He played rugby. He wasn't bad. He got a trial for Munster, which didn't work.
But this on is the Dev team, we're still talking about.
Yeah.
Okay,
right. But on the team were two brothers, the Ryan brothers. And there was mention in some of his biographies that they were quite good rugby players. And I looked them up. They're in the biography. They were on the Triple Crown winning side in 1890-something or other. And then at the very end of his career, he was delivering a speech in the Mansion House on the 50th anniversary of the foundation of Dáil Éireann. And he was heckled by a 1916 veteran called Joe Clark. So I looked him up, and he was a lifelong Republican activist. It turned out he had been under Dev's command in 1916 in Bowlands. And it turns out he was in there was an outpost at Mount Street Bridge, which very famously inflicted a load of casualties on British troops coming in from Dunleary. But he had a lifelong grudge against De Valera because he thought De Valera should have reinforced the lads at Mount Street because they were so successful, reinforced success and everything. So he had a lifelong grudge. So even though he had been his bonnet about political matters, he was also trying to get even with Dev. So there you go.
Well, he got it into the Dictionary of Irish Biography, so it wasn't no harm.
Absolutely.
And I mean, it's the key thing here is it's a trusted source, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
For the likes of you and historians.
Yeah.
So how has that come to be?
Well, it's a very rigorous checking process. So when they're writing an entry for this, they go back to the sources. Part of the problem when you're researching this, when you're researching anything, you know, things get repeated, which aren't necessarily accurate, or they get, you know, Chinese whispers, they get changed in the way. So, you know, something might be written in a book which isn't quite right, and then it gets printed in another book and another book and another book, and it becomes the accepted wisdom. So you kind of need to go back to the source to try and find out, establish the actual facts. So, you know, you can look at the entries in this and you might disagree with interpretations and you might disagree with the conclusions.
Okay.
But the facts are there and the facts are, by and large, are right.
It's so as good as you get, because you can put all you want into Google, but you got,
absolutely.
It's not going to be terribly reliable.
And the information might be correct, but it might not as well.
So dib.ie, it's like kind of a reliable Google. And the cool thing is you can search by name, you can search by profession as well.
Yeah, exactly. So if you wanted to research potato farmers in Clare in the 1800s, I don't know whether any of them would appear. But, for instance, you could do that and see if anything came up, so it's great.
You can even search pirate, apparently.
You can search pirate, I was just going to say. And this is like Pirates of the Caribbean. Anne Bonny. Born in County Cork, emigrated to South Carolina as a child with her parents. She got kicked out of the family home because she took up with a sailor who she subsequently married and moved to the Bahamas.
Oh,
so,
scandal.
Love story.
Scandal.
Didn't last long, though, because she came across a chap called Captain John Rackham, better known as Calico Jack. And she took up with him and she served on board his pirate ship along with another woman, actually.
I knew he was bad news.
Yeah, Calico Jack, yeah. She disguised herself as a man on board ship. She took part in raids armed with a machete and a pistol.
Wow.
But Calico Jack came to a bad end. They were captured. He was hung, drawn and quartered by the British authorities. But she was saved from the gallows because she was pregnant with his child the second time she had a child with him. And then her father, who had kicked her out of the house some years before, came back into her life, managed to get her out of prison. She returned to Charleston in South Carolina, where she married a local man, had 8 children and died at the age of 84.
What a life.
What a life.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And there's lots of interesting stories. There's also, this is an incredible story, Michael Dillon, who was born Laura Dillon in London in 1915.
Yeah.
Her brother became Baron Lismullen, which is the Irish connection, and lived in Ireland. She went to Oxford. She won a rowing blue. She represented the university at rowing. After she graduated, she'd always been uncomfortable with her female identity. She started working as a petrol pump attendant in a Bristol garage and began to pass as a man.
Right.
And then she was prescribed doses of testosterone, which had only recently been isolated and discovered, and then had her birth cert amended in 1944 and became Michael Dillon. And she then had plastic surgery and she became I think, the world's first surgically and hormonally reassigned female to male transsexual. So an absolute groundbreaker.
Yeah.
Michael then enrolled in Trinity College, studied medicine and won and represented the college at rowing. So probably the first and probably the last person to win a rowing blue, both as a man and as a woman. Graduated as a doctor, became a ship's physician, ended up in India, stayed in India, became a Buddhist monk. And then died in 1962. So if that is not
several lives,
that is several lives, and you know, if that isn't the basis for a novel, I don't know what is.
David, have you put McCullough in?
I have, yeah. Very disappointed. Very disappointed.
Well, in fairness, you're not the first McCullough to be a journalist, because it was Francis McCullough.
Yes.
I'm sure you've looked up.
Yeah.
And Francis, well, you can tell us if you've looked it up. From Tyrone.
From Tyrone, and a very adventurous career. I only glanced at it briefly, but he was a war correspondent. He covered wars in the Balkans. He covered the Russian Revolution. He got kicked out of Russia after writing about some of the things the Bolsheviks were up to that they didn't approve of. Yeah. He snuck back in. He went to, I had come across him actually before, because he in later life covered the Spanish Civil War and was very pro-Franco, so that was a bit embarrassing for the McCullough family name, I'm afraid.
Accused of being a British spy.
Yes. Yeah.
Which I'm sure you have as well, time to time, you know, mostly
one,
on Twitter.
One of the many things I've been accused of, yes.
Once you do 6-1. Mm. There was a Callan as well. They gave me a Callan who was very much into electricity, but the reason they really give it to me is because he decided to test the batteries out on some of his students to see how strong they were, just by shocking them. So
excellent.
Initially, when I heard scientists, I said unlikely to be related, but
now you're thinking
torturing,
maybe,
maybe. Up around Darver there as well. It's dangerously close up our part of the world as well. You did use these when you were doing your books. Have you got another book planned, by the way? Am I allowed to ask you that?
Yeah, you're allowed to ask.
So is there one?
No. Unfortunately,
that seems a bit lazy.
Yeah, it is a bit. It is a bit.
Because you've done John A. Costello.
Yes, and I did De Valera.
And two on Dev.
Yeah, well, that took the De Valera books took 8 years of my life, so I'm not anxious to rush into it. I might do something. Maybe I'll write a novel about Michael Dillon. You never know.
Which was the bestseller, by the way? Which sold better?
The De Valera books sold quite well.
We're just a bit obsessed, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. Yeah. Well, you know, I always thought of it as it's his life, obviously, which is important, but it's also the story of the Irish state. And if you don't understand about De Valera, you don't understand about a lot of what happened, about why society developed the way it did. And you know, people talk about De Valera's Ireland as if he created it single-handedly, which is nonsense, obviously, but he did have a role, you know.
But does it evoke a certain thing when somebody just says the word Dev?
Yeah, yeah.
And you almost think of just comely maidens dancing at the cross for...
which he never said. But anyway...
which is your point about unreliable history.
Yeah, absolutely. And the accepted wisdom... you know, I think the accepted wisdom about anybody, about any event, about any historical event needs to be questioned again and again. And, you know, I was very happy to write about John A. Costello. I was very happy to write about De Valera. And I'm quite sure there's somebody else somewhere doing something similar and adding in the same way that I use material that other people had gathered. They'll use what I did and progress further.
I thought that you might just be doing a high one. I thought it was time to do a
deep dive. At least two people writing writing high
biographies.
There is a bit, and I suspect they will be two very different books, but both very well worth reading.
Do you know what I want to ask you about, Deb? Because I know there's a big discussion in the UK at the moment about Winston Churchill, and I think one of the most read things in The Guardian over the last 2 days was, why are British people so afraid to discuss the sour aspects to it? Do you think we will reach that stage with Dev at some point?
That we can discuss the sour aspects.
But there's a kind of a...
don't think we do. Think
is it appropriate
the last
to have
years, we don't discuss anything else.
Yeah.
De Valera's place in the Irish psyche, I think, has been set by Neil Jordan, by the Michael Collins movie, which is a great movie.
Yeah.
A little bit unfair to De Valera.
That's put it mildly.
Yeah. Well, not entirely unfair to him. I mean, the last time we watched Michael Collins at home, I kept pausing it to point out historical inaccuracies until my wife and daughter told me to stop for some reason. I can't understand why. But
I don't know if you spotted the same one my father spotted, which was De Valera's kind of crying after Collins dies in a hay shed. But my father said the hay shed, no, those types of roundy hay sheds weren't around till the
50s. Afraid that's a completely new one for me. Great. So next time we watch it, I can point that out as well. Yeah. Brilliant.
That's a good footnote.
Yes.
And someone's asking, by the way, in the text, 51551, any views on Springsteen at the moment? That's a kind of a general question.
Yeah.
Actually, this is something I wanted to ask you, because he did the Jeep ad.
Yeah.
And that must have been controversial for Springsteen diehards.
It was, yeah. I mean, a lot of people were upset about it. You know, if people spent time on internet discussion forums, they would know that some of the fans were very upset about it. I thought it was a bit icky. But I mean, I remember him saying one time, somebody asked him, was he getting a sponsor for one of his tours, you know, the way a lot of bands do? And he said, no. There's been some rumour about it. And he said, no, if I was going to go that way, I would have endorsed Oreos in 1984 and really, you know, made out like a band. But I think what he was trying to do with the Jeep ad was it was a message about unity, you know, post Trump, and I think that's what he was trying to do. I thought it was a little bit odd. He's doing a
and it was his own Jeep, and he actually does drive one.
It's not quite as bad. But he's doing himself and Obama are doing a podcast at the moment.
I listened to a bit of that.
You'd want to be a fan. Both of them. It warms up a bit. There's a couple of there's going to be 8 episodes of 40 minutes apiece, so you'd be pretty invested. But there's a couple of points where Bruce starts playing a song, you know, it's just the two of them in the studio, and he picks up the guitar and plays a song, and that's amazing. But it's kind of diverting.
Are you still
enough
blown away by him like that?
Oh yeah.
Dedicated.
Yeah.
Attended David's talk. This is Marion from Lucan. Attended David talks about Dev 2 years ago in the Lucan library. Very interesting, learned a lot. So there you go. So Marion,
thank you very much.
Knock yourself out on dib.ie as well. I mean, yeah, the Springsteen thing. And of course, he was initially being arrested about over drink driving straight after that. Jeep pulled the ad.
Yeah.
And then the charges never happened.
Well, what happened was he was on his motorbike.
I knew you'd know all the details.
The way you are. He was on his motorbike in some national park in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And he was driving along, and some fans waved him down to get a photograph with him. So he, you know, took the photograph, and they had a bottle of tequila, and they offered him a shot of tequila, which he took and drank. He then got back on his bike and drove off, and there was two state troopers watching him, you know.
Yeah.
And whether they were Trump fans, who knows?
But anyway,
they
pulled him over,
and they charged him with careless driving, with drinking alcohol in a place where it's banned, which apparently is banned to drink alcohol in the state park, and with driving under the influence. And they did a breath test, and he was a fifth of the legal limit, but they still pressed the charges. So the driving under the influence charge was dropped in when it got to court, and he was fined $500 on the other things. And the judge said, I'm going to fine you $500, and you know you have X number of days in which to pay it. And Bruce says, I think I can pay it today, Your Honour. as you would.
The Jeep who had pulled the ad
put it back
reinstate
up again. Yeah.
They did.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, it was a bit odd. Like, he obviously knew these charges were coming up when he agreed to do the Jeep ad. So,
yes.
It's very strange.
That's right. And it was very last minute, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, he was. He's been exonerated once again in your eyes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, there's
an
idea staring you in the face, you know, Bruce Springsteen, his relationship with Ireland.
Yeah, it's already been done.
The latest tome.
A book called Land of Hope and Dreams is very good as well.
All right. But is that specifically about his relationship with Ireland?
Yeah.
Land of Hope and Dreams? Yeah. Okay.
There you go. There's always been someone there before you.
Okay, how are things? You're enjoying 6-1 News. You've been
great
there now since August?
September, yeah.
But you must be missing prime time.
I am, yeah. I mean, I
missing
great,
Miriam?
Missing Miriam, yes.
Genuinely,
yeah. Which she never says, ever. And certainly, even if she was tempted to say it, she wouldn't. We had a great time on prime time for 7 years, but you know. Things move on, things change. So
I think people have noticed your eyebrows are different now on 6-1 because there was a thing, wasn't it, on prime time?
Well, people said there was a thing. I was never really aware of it myself. But
the editorial eyebrow.
Yeah. Well. Oh God. No. We can't do that. can't editorialise, Oliver. You know.
Not even through the form of the eyebrows.
Yeah.
Listen, dib.ie. It's a really good thing. As you said yourself earlier, it's like a rabbit hole, isn't it, for historians?
Yeah. I mean, in theory, this should increase productivity in the history nerd community, but I suspect it will decrease it because once you open it up, you just can't stop looking at different stories.
DIB.ie, you have done the state some service, Mr. McCullough. Good day to you and happy Springsteen forever.
Thank you very much.
Good morning.